Good morning. As we continue today, we're walking through the series on sojourners and exiles. And I mentioned when we started a few weeks ago that we're going to be in Daniel a lot. That's not the only place we're going to be. And we've already looked at Jeremiah and a few other places in Scripture, both Old and New Testament. But if you've missed pieces of the series so far, just know that the video and audio is all online. We are also, while you can watch the Bible Project video that I shared the first week, I am going to share a link on that and some other resources in the coming weeks that will be available to you as well. But that the theme of exile that we see, we realized over the last few weeks, it was not just an issue for Israel. And we understand that in Daniel, we are following specifically Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, Daniel and his three friends, as they're, because of their education and their background, they're given an opportunity to serve in Nebuchadnezzar's court in Babylon. And so you have this theme of Israel being in exile, and yet, as the prophet Jeremiah challenged Israel, they were to basically live within Babylon and seek the welfare of the city while they maintain their ultimate loyalty to God. And so that theme of exile, where we understand that this world is not our own, or our home, that we're living in a place where we wait for our heavenly home to come, that theme is carried over in the New Testament. That for God's people, we understand that earthly kings and earthly kingdoms will fade, but that our being a part of God's kingdom, when we come to faith in Christ, we become Christ followers and put our faith and hope in Him, when we make Christ king of our lives, we enter into a new kingdom. And that's the kingdom that we looked at in that first week of that Daniel talked about in interpreting Nebuchadnezzar's dream, that picture of a kingdom that would come that would have no end. That's the kingdom that we live in. This idea of exile introduces that idea of, okay, if we live in a world that is not really our home, do we put ourselves in a place of choosing to compromise our convictions and our values and what God has called us, or how God has called us to live? Or do we resist and do we fight? And the Bible Project video, I think, was really helpful 2 weeks ago of explaining that those really aren't the only two options. And that when you look at Jeremiah and the call to seek the welfare of the city, is that we are to be seeking the welfare of the community where we live. We're to seek the welfare of our nation. We're to seek the welfare of the world in which we live, while at the same time remembering that our ultimate loyalty is to God and His truth. That theme is at the center of the story today as well. And we're going to be reading the entire book of Daniel. Let me try that again. We're not going to read the entire book of Daniel. The entire chapter of Daniel 3. Yeah, we'll see. We'll be done about 4 or 5 o'clock. We're going to be reading the entirety of Daniel 3 today. And this is a story, if you grew up in the church, the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and the fiery furnace, I mean, that was definitely one of my favorite stories as a kid. This is probably a story that's pretty familiar to you. But I want us to walk through it, and we're just going to walk through it and highlight some of the principles that we see in this as it relates not only to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, because Daniel's really not even in the story. We don't really know where Daniel is in this chapter. But there's clearly, from what we see in this chapter, a direct parallel to how we live as exiles in this world. And so let's just go ahead and dive into Daniel 3, verses 1 through 3. The words are on the screen. No one had commented the last few weeks the slides that I was using. Did anyone see the little word that was down on the bottom right of the box? I wonder, why was it Lent? Why were we using a Lent slide? I realized that the first week. Couldn't figure out a way to remove just that because I liked the slide. So anyways, we changed the background today. So for those of you that were confused thinking that the last few weeks had anything to do with Lent, I'm sure I can make a connection somehow, but anyways, so hopefully this slide background works for you. Daniel 3, verses 1 through 3. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits, and its breadth 6 cubits. It's 90 feet high, 9 feet wide, which is really kind of a weird proportion when you think about it. It's extremely tall, narrow. Even though 9 feet is pretty wide, it's not when it's 90 feet tall. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, and the magistrates, and all the officials and provinces to come to the dedication of the image that the King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So he's all the political rulers that are under the king and all of his counselors, and they're, anyone with a position of power or of authority are coming to this dedication of this statue. Verse 3 says, then the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors and the treasurers, and the justices, and the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. What's interesting, if you were here last week, or if you know Daniel 2, that image that was at the heart of Nebuchadnezzar's dream, do you remember the head was gold, and it represented King Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon. And each of the parts of that statue going away from the gold to the silver and the bronze and the clay, those images were of the different kingdoms that would follow Babylon. That's good to keep in mind, because now Daniel 2 ended with what seemed to be a positive response from Nebuchadnezzar, that he recognized that God was at work through Daniel. But here, you see now Nebuchadnezzar erecting this statue that's not just a head of gold, but the entire statue is of gold. He's making a very clear statement in this moment that this statue represents his kingdom of Babylon, and that none of those nations will ever follow. He's making a declaration, a statement of his greatness and Babylon's greatness, and really kind of just pushing aside what he learned from the experience with Daniel's interpretation of the dream in chapter 2. He's stating there's no greater kingdom than his, and no other kingdom will follow. So that's what we have. We have Nebuchadnezzar erecting this statue. So what he seemed to be showing some progress and recognizing God being at work in Daniel. But now you see the pride of Nebuchadnezzar. You see the pride of Babylon in the erection of this statue. And then in the invitation that we're going to see in verse 4 through 7. Let's pick up in verse 4. It says, and the herald proclaimed aloud, you are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, the pipe, the lyre, the trigon, the harp, the bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning, fiery furnace. Therefore, as soon as the peoples heard the sound of the horn, the pipe, the lyre, the trigon, the harp, the bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Picking up in verse 8. It says, therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans, and again, we know from the previous chapters that the counselors that Nebuchadnezzar has around him, that certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, the pipe, the lyre, the trigon, the harp, the bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning, fiery furnace. There are certain Jews among you who have appointed that you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. In this picture, we have a picture of idolatry. And I think it was about a year ago when we were working on through the worship series, we spent a few weeks dealing with what idolatry really is. The idea of bowing and worshiping in an idol, we don't fully understand that in our culture, because we don't necessarily build idols of gold. Or statues or different things like that. We talked about the fact that the idols, that the issue of idolatry, when we look through the Old and the New Testament, challenge us to really understand that God wants all of us. He doesn't want to compete for our love and our attention and our loyalty. And there were three things we specifically looked at when we looked at that last year, that the issue of idolatry and what God actually calls us to in rejecting idolatry is that it's not an issue of priority. Do you remember? Some of you may remember this. But it's an issue of exclusivity. Sometimes we fall into this idea of saying, well, I can worship God and have this, this, and this that I'm also giving my love and my attention to. God alone deserves our worship, and he alone deserves our ultimate loyalty. We looked at the issue of idolatry as being, by making a physical representation, the ancient world, they were creating things that they could control. And there was a sharp contrast in the God of the Old and New Testament is that we worship a God who is above his creation, and he can't be manipulated and controlled. But we also understood when we looked at the issue of idolatry last year is that God deserves or desires our exclusive devotion. Not only in our outward acts, but from our hearts. He wants us to be fully surrendered and fully devoted to him. The issue of idolatry is such a central thing in the Christian life of making sure that there are not things in our hearts and our lives that are competing for our love, our attention, and our devotion. And we have to be guarding our heart against those things. But what we find in this chapter, in this story, and we're gonna dive back into the story after we share a little bit more about the idea of idolatry and what's happening here. This story gives a very specific picture of a specific type of idolatry. And it's an idea of idolatry of making an idol out of the state. The state being kings or kingdoms. Lowercase k kingdom compared to God's kingdom. And if you don't think that may be the case, look at verse 12. Verse 12, you see that in the accusation made against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, is that he said, "O king," and they puff up Nebuchadnezzar's ego, "you great king." He says, "These men pay no attention to you, they do not serve your gods. And they do not worship the image you have set up." There's a clear connection between King Nebuchadnezzar himself, his religion, the gods that he worships, and this call of the connection then to the third piece of this is the statue. So the statue represents not only Nebuchadnezzar and his gods, it gives a picture that helps us understand why Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego could not bow and surrender and bow and worship, because they couldn't, while they could seek the welfare of Babylon, they could seek the welfare of Nebuchadnezzar, they could not surrender and recognize loyalty to Babylon over their loyalty to God. Nebuchadnezzar, his gods, and the image are linked together, and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, at the risk of their life, reject it. We understand that issue, that specific form of idolatry, was something that Israel struggled with. Remember, Israel is in exile because they failed to follow God in his law. They allowed their hearts to drift away from God and trust other nations and trust other things rather than walking in obedience to the God who called Abraham. But if you look at Israel's history, from the point that Israel demanded to have a king, you remember the story? I mean, basically God just says, "Okay, I'll give you a king." And so Israel gets Saul as a king. And Saul loses the kingdom when he fails to recognize that God is ultimately in control and demands full obedience. And that even Saul as king had to recognize the authority of God in his life and in the kingdom. We see through the prophets, as Israel is preparing to go into exile or are in exile, that the prophets call Israel to return to God and not trust the other nations to save them. It's all through the prophets. That issue of trusting Egypt or trusting, at one point even trusting Babylon or Assyria, these other nations, of putting their faith and confidence in a kingdom, an earthly kingdom, rather than trusting God and walking with him. We see that theme, and I think I have the words for this verse up on the screen, Psalm 20, verses 6 through 7. This theme is of challenging this idea of idolatry. We see in Psalm 20, verse 6 through 7, it says, "Now I know that the Lord saves his anointed. He will answer him from his holy heaven with the saving might of his right hand. Some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we trust in the name of the Lord our God." Israel in this moment is, again, finding themselves in exile. They've been challenged to make their homes in exile, again, going back to Jeremiah, to make their homes there, to live among the people and to seek the welfare of Babylon, but they have to maintain their ultimate loyalty to God. And this is not only just an issue of loyalty, to say that their loyalty is not to Babylon. Their loyalty, even while they are in exile, is to their God. There's also an issue of idolatry that connects to the issue of what we trust, where we put our confidence, where we put our hope. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and what we're going to see in their actions and not bowing, was that they were not going to put their trust in Nebuchadnezzar or Babylon. They were going to put their trust in the God who would deliver them. That theme carries over into the New Testament. 1 Peter 2:17 says, "We're to honor everyone, we're to love the brotherhood, we're to fear God, and honor the emperor." We're to give honor to everyone and honor to the emperor, but only one is deserving of a true worship and loyalty when we're called to fear God. Remember Jesus' words when he's asked, "Do we pay taxes to Caesar or to Rome?" Matthew 22:19-21, he says, "Show me the coin for the tax." And they brought him a denarius. And Jesus said to them, "Whose likeness and inscription is on this?" And they said, "Caesar's." And then he said to them, "Therefore render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." We need to remember that our ultimate loyalty is to God. In that moment, and we're going to finish the story here in a little bit, but in that moment, these three men are being faced with a choice of saying, "I'm just going to compromise, I'm going to give in, and I'm going to bow and worship and put my and recognize the loyalty of our loyalty to the King Nebuchadnezzar would be greater than their loyalty to God." It would not just be an issue of compromise, but at its heart, it was an issue of worship and recognizing that their trust needed to remain in God himself. What we see in this story is a reminder that as God's people, our ultimate loyalty is always to God. God and his kingdom. But it's also an issue of trust, and that our confidence in what we trust needs to be in God alone. But we also need to be willing to critique the king and the kingdoms of this world. Think about this. The idea that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would not bow when everyone else is bowing, in any of the cartoons or the movies or portrayals of this, you always see all this crowd of people bowing and three men standing alone. In making that statement, these are three men that are serving Babylon. They're working for the king. They're seeking the welfare of Babylon, but in that moment they recognize they can't surrender. They can't surrender and give more loyalty to the earthly king. And they can't put their trust and their faith in this earthly king, that they needed to remain true to the God who had called them. In that moment, they're making a critique, saying, "Yeah, we can serve. We can serve in your court. We can do all these things. We can be engaged. We can be a part of what is happening in Babylon. But there is going to be a line and a time where we're going to have to say, I cannot bow. I cannot surrender." That idea, that third piece of not moving beyond where our loyalty is and what we trust, that third piece of the willingness to critique the kings and kingdoms of this world, history is littered with examples of where the church failed to do this. And there were incredibly destructive results. Probably none greater than in Nazi Germany. One of the saddest realities is that many of the German theologians And much of the German church supported the rise of Adolf Hitler. And I want to read a quote from one of the leaders within that movement. He says, "One cannot be a good German and at the same time deny God." You might think that sounds okay so far, but I'm going to keep reading. He says, "One cannot be a good German and at the same time deny God, but an arousal of faith in the eternal German is the same time an arousal of faith in the eternal God. If we act as true Germans, we act according to the laws of God. Whoever serves Adolf Hitler, the Führer, serves Germany. And whoever serves Germany serves God." Adolf Hitler relied on what became the state church to support. He used the church to help propel him to power and authority. Bonhoeffer, if you have not read Dietrich Bonhoeffer, I highly recommend you look at his life and his example, was a German theologian and pastor who stood up and said, "This isn't right." And I want to read a description of some of the things about Bonhoeffer's life, that he saw this dangerous movement happening where theologians and churches were compromising and supporting this young Adolf Hitler and the rise of Nazism. Dietrich Bonhoeffer took a stand. He says, "When it came clear that Hitler intended to use the German church for his own purposes, Bonhoeffer went to London and became an English pastorate member. He refused to recognize the public church, the church in Germany, which became an instrument of Hitler's policies and supported the establishment of the confessional church." We know that Bonhoeffer, though, later, with the support of the Christians in England, he felt led to go back to Germany. And he went back not only as a protest to Nazism, but he went back and actually worked against Hitler and actually was involved in a plot to overthrow Hitler, which led him to being put into a concentration camp. And a few days before the end of World War II, Dietrich Bonhoeffer lost his life. Bonhoeffer saw that Hitler and the Nazi movement was using the church. People in those churches were forgetting that their ultimate loyalty was not to an earthly king or earthly kingdom, but their ultimate loyalty was to God and his kingdom. In our life, when we think about idolatry, when we look at this chapter, and I think most of my time growing up, I looked at this idea, this was like the story to help us understand peer pressure. When everyone else in the world is bowing or doing whatever, we need to stand true. And that is absolutely a central part of this story. But you really can't read this story and understand this story unless you look at those verses and understand that this has everything to do with Nebuchadnezzar placing himself in a place where he's demanding ultimate loyalty, demanding that we trust him and Babylon alone. And yet, three young men were willing to stand and give critique and remain loyal. Let's pick up in verse 13. "Then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage," we're going to see Nebuchadnezzar has some anger issues. "Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, 'Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready when you hear the sound of the horn, the pipe, okay, can we skip this whole list of instruments, and fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?'" Think about those words. He's basically giving them a chance to say, "Look, I'm going to play the music. This can all be put behind us. Just when the music plays, bow down and worship." He says, "But if you don't, who's going to deliver you out of my hands?" Nebuchadnezzar in this moment is putting his pride and his view of his own life and his power and the power of his kingdom at odds with God. And we know through reading throughout the Old Testament and the story of Israel's life, we understand that didn't work for Pharaoh and it's not going to work for Nebuchadnezzar. That the greatest nations of this earth will fade away. And it's a dangerous thing to lift yourself up, to puff yourself up, to think that your power is greater than God himself. That question of who is this God who will deliver you out of my hand sets up everything else in the story. Let's pick up in verse 16. He says, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. I love that. I mean, they're working for the king. They're seeking the welfare of the king and the welfare of Babylon. But in this matter, they understood where their loyalty remained and says, King, we really don't even have to give you an answer here. But they go on. Verse 17, if this be so, if they're thrown into the fiery furnace, if this be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Such an incredible statement of conviction. They know in this moment, they know in this moment that their lives are in jeopardy. But they remain loyalty. They remain loyal to God. They're going to trust God to care for them, to deliver them, to provide for them, even at the risk of their own life. That statement in their response in verses 16 through 18 says, if this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from this burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. You see in that statement that they are confident that God is able to deliver them. They have no doubt in that. They don't know if he will, but they know that he is able. And so there's a confidence that you see in this moment from these three young men that they have a full confidence and trust in God's ability to deliver them in this moment of testing. But they go on to say, but if not, we will not serve your gods. But if not, we will not worship the golden image. They're basically saying, look, we know God is able to deliver us. He may not, but whatever happens, we're going to trust God and know that we are going to stay true to our commitment, our ultimate loyalty to God. We're going to trust him whether he is to deliver us or not. We're going to trust him, and we are not going to serve and worship your false gods. Verse 19. Again, Nebuchadnezzar filled with fury. The expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. That suggests that maybe he was hoping for a more positive response from these three young men, that they would cooperate. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated. And he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, which I'm sure infuriated Nebuchadnezzar even more. He's losing some of his own men. But verse 23 says, and these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. This next section, you can kind of picture this. Somehow, Nebuchadnezzar has a view to what's happening here. So he's able to look down and see this scene of what's happening. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego have been thrown to their death. And from what you saw happen to these soldiers who threw them in, them losing their life, they wouldn't have lasted long. unless God intervened. And this is my favorite part of this whole chapter because there's some comedy to this. Verse 24, it says, "Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he rose up in haste." So he's sitting, he's watching this, and he looks down and he's counting one, two, three. Wait, there's four. He jumps out of his throne and he declares to his counselors, "Did we not cast three men bound into the fire?" And they answered and said to the king, "True, O king." And he answered and said, "But I see four men unbound walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the fourth is like the son of the gods." In this image, we have an incredible reminder in this theme we see throughout Scripture. God invites us to trust him, to maintain our ultimate loyalty to him. But when we do that, we can trust that God is going to be present with us. The promise of God's presence with us when we trust him, when we put our confidence in him rather than the world around us, is that he is going to walk with us. In this image, this image of this fourth individual being described by Nebuchadnezzar as being like the son of the gods, some interpretations of this is that that's just an angel. Most conservative interpretations of this is not just an angel, but this is Christ himself. What theologians would call a Christophany or a theophany, where Jesus, prior to the incarnation being born into this world, makes an appearance in the Old Testament. It's where I land. I think this is definitely one of those examples where Jesus himself stands and they're walking in the midst of this fiery furnace with his three faithful young men. That reminder of God's presence with us is something that that gives us the confidence to know when we take a stand and we trust God and trust his kingdom over the smaller kingdoms of this world, that we can trust and believe and have confidence that God is going to be with us, even if it leads us to a place of persecution and death. Daniel 3, 26 through 27 goes on. It says, "Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace, and he declared, 'Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here.' And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the fire. And the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire the fire had not had any power over the bodies of those men. The hair on their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them." I mean, think about that. We can't sit around a campfire without smelling like smoke. The protection that God provided for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in this moment not only protected the hair on their heads, their eyebrows aren't burnt off. There's nothing to demonstrate that they have been exposed to the fire. Not even the smell of fire is on them. God's protection was complete. God's protection was full. What we see in that is echoed in the words of the prophet Isaiah. Isaiah 43:2 says, "When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And through the rivers, they shall not overwhelm you. When you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned, and the flame shall not consume you." We can trust that God will be present with us in trial, but we also, not only does he promise his presence, but we can trust him to protect us. Marty reminded us of the call from the end of Ephesians in that series of putting on the whole armor of God. We can put our confidence and trust in him. We may experience persecution. We could even experience death, but we know that God is going to be with us and he's going to protect us. And if we were to die, we know that man can take our body, but he cannot take our soul. And that's the witness of the martyrs throughout the history of the church, is that we, when we stay true to God, we have the confidence that God will either deliver us in that moment, or if we breathe our last, we're going to have the promise that to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. And we're going to have the promise of resurrection, that this life is not the end. that witness from Stephen, the first martyr, on was that God will be with us, he will protect us, and we have the hope of resurrection. Really, the scene you have of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego being thrown into what seems to be a pit of fire, them coming out, is really foreshadows and gives us an image of resurrection. And at the heart of the Christian life, of us putting our faith and trust in Jesus and what he did on the cross for us, is not only believing that he died for our sin and that we can trust him and know forgiveness, but then in putting our faith and trust in Jesus and his resurrection, we know that our eternal future is secure. We have the hope of our resurrection because of Jesus and his resurrection. And that is an image of those three men coming out of the fire, coming out of what was should have been certain death, reminds us of the power of God's resurrection. Daniel 3, 28 through 30 says, in verse 28, Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants, and who trusted in him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies, rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree, any problem or any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb." Again, the guy's got anger issues here. "And their houses will be laid in ruins, for there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. You see the shift here? Nebuchadnezzar went from, well, who is this God that's going to deliver you out of my hand, to making the statement that there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way. Nebuchadnezzar, in this moment, he witnesses this miraculous rescue of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And so in two consecutive chapters, you have King Nebuchadnezzar, the person who had more power and authority in the known world at that time. In that moment, in both chapter 2 and chapter 3, you see him recognizing the power of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's God. Because they see God gave Daniel the interpretation of the dream. He sees this ultimate protection, this incredible protection that was provided for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and actually witnessed this, what he described as an angel being present with them in a moment that they should have been being consumed in fire. But I would say this, that not only did Nebuchadnezzar see this miracle, but in his words describing Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, he also saw their witness. And while he was infuriated by their unwillingness to bow, their unwillingness to surrender and recognize his power and the power represented in the statue, while he was infuriated by that, he says in verse 28, he basically gives a description of the true witness that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had in their integrity, in their convictions. Look at verse 28 and 29 again. He said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants." So he's recognizing the miracle that God acted. He saved them. But then he describes what he sees that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did. They trusted in him. They trusted their God rather than hearing this veiled threat from Nebuchadnezzar and say, what God is going to save you? And it says that while they trusted, they set aside the king's command and they yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. They were willing to lay down their lives before they would be willing to bow their hearts and their lives in surrender to a false king, an earthly king. When we remain faithful to God and we refuse to worship and serve the idols of man, when we remember this story, we know that very likely persecution may come. And there's a breed of Christianity today that somehow sees being persecuted as contrary to the Christian faith, even though Jesus promised, if the world hated him, they're going to hate you. If they persecuted me, they're going to persecute you. And we have the witness of the apostles and the martyrs to know that, I mean, the history of the church is filled with people who laid down their lives because of their devotion to Jesus Christ and his kingdom. They were willing to lay down their lives to remain true and loyalty to God. They put their confidence in a God who could deliver them, that was able to deliver them without any promise that he would. But as Christians, we know that even if someone were to take our lives, we have the hope of resurrection. That the salvation God gives us is not just a salvation for this life, it's a salvation for the next life. While we remain faithful to God and refuse to worship and serve idols of man, persecution may come, but we can trust God is with us. We can trust God will deliver us. Our witness, as we live in this place as exiles, recognizing this is not our home, we need to be really examining our hearts and our lives and say, where are our loyalties? Where is our confidence? And our loyalties and our confidence so much in God and his kingdom that we're willing to actually be critical and offer critique to the kings and kingdoms of this world. Over the next few months, I think it's going to be critical for Christ followers to remember that our ultimate loyalty is not the United States. Our ultimate loyalty is not the Republican or Democratic Party. Our ultimate loyalty is to God himself. And I have to tell you, if you are feeling anxiety over what is going on in the world politically, I want to ask you, where is your confidence? Are you trusting in a political leader? Are you trusting the God who still has the world in his hands? Remember, we're called to seek the welfare of the city, which means I'm not telling you don't vote. I'm not telling you don't be involved, don't be engaged. We need to be engaged. We need to be seeking the welfare of the city, which means we need to be praying for our country. We need to be praying for all of our elected leaders. We need to be praying for our local communities. We need to be praying for God's blessing upon the United States of America, recognizing God has blessed us greatly. But in doing that, we need to remember that our ultimate loyalty is not to an earthly politician or leader or an earthly political party. Our ultimate loyalty is to God. And we don't need to be anxious or concerned because God is still on the throne. Our confidence is not to be in a party. Our confidence is not to be in a leader. Our confidence is to be in God himself. And we need to embrace and understand that we live as exiles and sojourners in a kingdom that is coming. And while we live in this new kingdom, we need to be willing to stand up when there's times where our earthly kings and kingdoms are adopting policies or have moral character issues in their life, whatever the issues, we need to be willing to stand up and say, this is wrong, and this is where we stand. That idea of offering critique to kings and kingdoms, I want to clarify. What I see today, and if you stream through social media, it's real easy to critique the other guy. But when we stand true to kingdom principles, you're also going to find that there are going to be times where you critique your own guy or lady. Because if our convictions and our commitments and our loyalty and our confidence is to God and his kingdom above any earthly kingdom, we need to be willing to call out behavior, character, policies, or things that are inconsistent with God and his kingdom, even when it might be the person that we embrace. And saying, look, I don't feel like I have too many good options here, and this is who I'm going to choose. But we need to be willing to stay true to our commitment to stand up and say, like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, stand when everyone else is bowing and saying, I can't bow on this issue. If you never are willing to offer a critique of your own guy, I want to ask you, where is your confidence and where is your true loyalty? Because I'm pretty well convinced that there's no political leader and there's no political party that fully represents God in his kingdom. And I thank God for the fact that we are invited to be a part of a king and a kingdom where all things will become new. And I look forward to the day that, every knee and every tongue, every knee will bow, every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. And in the meantime, while we live as exiles and sojourners in this world waiting for that day, we need to find this balance of how we can seek the welfare of the city, we can be engaged, we can be involved, and, seek God's blessing in the world around us, but at the same time, know when we need to stand instead of bow. You pray with me. Dear Heavenly Father, I just pray that any of the words that I shared today that maybe were not helpful, Lord, I pray that you would just redeem this message. My heart is concerned for the life of the church, not just this nation. Lord, help us to see those moments where we're surrendering our loyalty to earthly kings and kingdoms, where we're putting our trust and our confidence in those earthly kings and kingdoms instead of trusting you, O God, who still holds this world in your hands. Help us to have a vision of God's kingdom that, will carry us through an election, will carry us through, Lord, whatever this future holds for us. Lord, may we be so enmeshed in, your kingdom and, living in your word and, Lord, seeking to, recognize your kingdom over the kingdoms of this world, that we're willing to stand and, even critique when it may not seem advantageous to critique because we might be critiquing our own party or our own leader. Lord, help us to remember where our true loyalties lie and where that we can have a full confidence and trust in you. We do this not only because you, give us this witness as, something that you're telling us we need to do, but Lord, may we remember that when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego stood true and they experienced this persecution, it was a witness to the world around them. Lord, help us to remain true to you in this day. Lord, that the world may see that while we seek to be a blessing to the world around us, our ultimate loyalty and our ultimate trust is in you, Jesus. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.